of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way? All covered up in a world that gives it all away. Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, we have started discussing, some of the jurisprudential laws concerning haram gains based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei from a couple of episodes ago onwards. And we'd like to do so in this episode and hopefully in the upcoming episodes, Sheikh Javid. Some people, in fact, sell military uniforms in the non-Muslim countries. Is it permissible to trade in this line of business? And is it permissible to buy uniforms, military uniforms, from them and use them?
Well, if there is a possibility that they acquired these uniforms in accordance with the law, or maybe they are authorized to such to sell them, there is no problem in buying from them and making use of them in a way which is compatible with regulations. Mm-hmm. Okay. Because without, regulations,
yes,
you cannot wear the uniform.
Yes.
And you cannot use these uniforms unless you are allowed by the law and the regulation.
I see. What's the Islamic law on the manufacturer's purchase or use of fireworks and explosive materials, regardless of whether or not they are of the type that may cause annoyance to people?
Well, it's not permissible if they pose harm and annoyance to others, or indulging in them is regarded as a kind of wastefulness or squandering. So it's not permissible. Usually, of course, such explosives, explosive materials, when used, result in annoyance of other people, wasting money, and also even casualties. And in which case, of course, it's not permissible.
Mm-hmm, I see. Well, Sheikh Javid, what's the ruling on the work of a policeman or woman or the traffic cop and employees of the departments of customs and tax in whether Islamic or non-Islamic countries?
Yeah.
Are these types of jobs that are referred to in some hadith that no supplication would be answered if it came from a sergeant or a tax collector?
Well, as far as the work is concerned, there's no problem in their work in and of itself, provided that it is carried out in compliance with the laws. But it seems that the sergeant or tax collector mentioned in the examples, of course, are those serving in tyrannical governments.
Yes.
Of course, those are out of the question. Mm-hmm. So, generally speaking, there's no problem in the work they do, the work of the policemen and traffic, policemen, cop, and employees of departments of customs, as you said.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. We'll be back momentarily.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. I'm Sheikh Chowdhury, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws regarding haram gains based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini with Sheikh Chowdhury. Sheikh Chowdhury, some women work in beauty parlors or beauty stores and shops to provide an income for their families. Doesn't it lead to a kind of immorality, which in turn is bound to undermine chastity of the Islamic societies?
Well, there is no objection to working in beautifying women, as mentioned in the example.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a problem also to get paid for it, provided that wearing of the makeup is not intended for showing it to non-mahram, of course, non-mahram individuals.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there are women coming to the beauty parlor, and it's the person working in the beauty parlor has nothing to do with the, mm-hmm. with whether the woman is going to show her adornment, her makeup to non-mahram or not.
Yes,
she actually does her job or the job she's required to do, and then it depends on that client whether she wants to conceal her makeup from non-mahram or not. So she should do so, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the work, the makeup, the cosmetic process is concerned, the adornment, the use of, let's say, different items are concerned, there's no problem.
Mm-hmm. Sheikh Chowdhury, is it permissible to work as an intermediary or facilitator between the builders and the owners to get paid for their services?
There's no problem in getting paid for halal work. As long as you're doing halal work, of course, it is quite permissible.
Mm, I see. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Don't go away.
اللهم صل على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وآله.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Chowdhury, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws regarding haram gains based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini with Sheikh Chowdhury. Sheikh Chowdhury, you know, in some businesses, in fact, or work, some commission is given to the person who work as an intermediary or agent or whatever you call it. So this is a money paid to the, for example, a state agent, a real estate agent.
Yes.
Is this commission halal?
Well, commission is the money that you receive after you make an arrangement for it.
Mm.
You just
yes.
talk to some people, you get their consent, and those people who give you some money, which you call commission, they give it out of their own consent. So there is no problem in that, provided that he gets paid for halal work. It depends, because if you are going to do some halal work and you receive the commission, which is actually a kind of wage that you receive from the people, there is no problem. And it's done at the request of the other people.
Right.
You're not doing it, you know, on you know, unilaterally.
Yes.
Without consulting other people.
I see. What's the Islamic ruling on the salaries paid to the professors and teachers who teach jurisprudence and fundamentals of jurisprudence in theology colleges?
There's no problem in it. The obligation to teach that who's teaching is a kifayi obligation does not detract from the permissibility of getting paid for it. In other words, of course, teaching some things are, let's say, a collective duty. And when one person undertakes to do it, other people are relieved of the obligation. So that's what we call wajib kifayi. So, but it doesn't mean that if you do it, you cannot get paid for it. You can do it. So the money that you receive for a wajib act, like for example, teaching the Holy Quran to someone, it is good. Teaching the fundamentals of faith to children, to youngsters, to teenagers, is okay. It's very good, highly recommended. It's in some cases it's wajib, but if you get paid, there's no objection. You can receive the money.
As a salary?
As a payment, which is halal, of course. It may not be a salary.
I know that the gifts are okay, but
the gifts are okay.
But what about the salaries?
Yeah, of course you can even stipulate for it. I will do so. Provided that you pay me some money.
I see. Quite related to this, Sheikh Javid, what's the ruling on giving instructions in religious matters? And is it permissible for the clergies who are engaged in this type of work to be remunerated?
Although teaching halal and haram matters is an obligation, but there's no problem in getting paid for it. Because these scholars of religion, they need to support their family, and they usually teach jurisprudence. They teach halal and haram things to people. The people should also pay them some money in order for them to be able to support their families back home.
Okay, Sheikh. You know, about the haram gains, you know, if somebody has obtained... an individual has obtained by any way possible, and it didn't know it, and it was unconscious of the the religious rules about it, and he has obtained the haram gains. So, what does he have to do with the haram gains? Does he have to give it back, like to the person who he got it from in the first place, or he has to give it back to the poor, for example, or give it to the religious authorities?
Well, of course, as we can clearly understand from the word haram gain or gains, there are some, for example, some examples of haram gain like cheating, stealing, corruption, murder, interest, and so on and so forth. These are means of haram gains, and which they, of course, involve harm to another human being. So once a person gains something through illicit means, it is necessary that he return the amount he has gained to the original owner. For example, if he has stolen money from a store, there are people who say that, okay, in my childhood, I used to steal from the store, from a local store, from the maybe supermarket, and now I realized that, okay, I did a very bad act, a sinful act. What should I do? The answer is that he should return the money to to the store or to the original owner. But of course, if it involves embarrassment, he can get it back or return it in one way or another.
If the person is not available.
if the person is not available, of course his heir, people who are close to that person, and they are still alive, so he should return the money to the
Okay,
to
the thank heir. You very much, Chavit. And thank you, my dear listeners, for tuning in and listening to your own program, Islamic Laws, whereby we usually discuss some of the jurisprudential laws regarding a particular concept. And in this episode and the previous one, and hopefully in the upcoming episodes, we try to delve into some of these jurisprudential laws regarding unlawful gains based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. From me and the rest of the crew, we bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي المميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
Tonight on Exposé, Western broadcast media is accusing The Lancet of blood libel after the British Medical Journal issued a harrowing warning that the true death toll of the Gaza conflict could exceed 186,000, accounting for 8% of Gaza's population. In our digital media section, we expose the New York Times portrayal of Zionist Israel's assaults on Gaza as a one-sided narrative, vilifying Palestinians while justifying the Israeli occupation army's breaches of international law. And a Delta poll survey of over 2,000 adults reveals 45% of Brits support recognition of an independent Palestine, while 54% support the UK banning arms sales to the Israeli regime. Welcome to Exposé, the show that leaves no stone unturned. A conservative estimate of 4 indirect deaths for 1 direct death reported in Gaza, a new study published respected medical journal The Lancet said it is not implausible to estimate that almost 200,000 deaths could be attributable to the genocide war in Gaza. Let us hear from Fuad Itayim, our broadcast expert, more about it in Fake News Exposé. The British medical journal The Lancet issued a harrowing warning that the true death toll of the Gaza conflict could be over 186,000, accounting for 8% of Gaza's population. The current official death toll stands at nearly 38,000, according to the health ministry in Gaza. However, The Lancet's recent report, titled Counting the Dead in Gaza Difficult but Essential, suggests this figure is a significant underestimate. How did the broadcast media cover this new devastating results? Let us see with Fuad Itayim in Fake News Exposé. Thank you for being here, Fuad.
Thank you for having me. Marwa, sadly, the true number that this British medical journal is publishing likely includes thousands of Gazans who are still trapped under the rubble. Mm-hmm. And, of course, those who have succumbed to the secondary effects of the conflict, starvation, malnutrition, disease, lack of sanitation, lack of medical care. Of course, we remember that there's almost no functioning hospitals in Gaza. Let's also remind our viewers that a major contributor to this extensive and unprecedented loss of life is the 14,000 bombs weighing each 2,000 pounds that the U.S. has been sending to Israel. So these bombs have not only caused immediate casualties, but have also devastated Gaza's infrastructure mm-hmm. and exacerbated all these conditions that lead to the additional deaths, like the lack of sanitation and the you know, the disease and mm-hmm. the famine, you know. So moving on to U.S. mainstream media that showed complete bias towards Israel, of course, with zero regard or concern to the rising death toll of civilians. For example, CBN News in this piece simply puts the real perspective of what global Zionist supremacy means when it comes to the fact that white Anglo-Saxon privileged societies think of brown natives living in this region 9,000 miles away from the U.S. East Coast.
Now more than ever, it's time for what we've always called the free world, the Western democracies, to stand in solidarity with Israel. This is a terror threat, and it's based on ideology that is fundamentally flawed and, from a moral standpoint, absolutely wrong. What Hezbollah and Hamas want to do is wipe Israel off the map. They want to kill every single Jew. That is a call to genocide. That's a call to jihad. That is a call that is resonating right now within the fundamentalist Muslim community.
It's not only confined to racist news outlets like CBN, but it's backed by polls and surveys with results that are completely compatible with this form of, you know, vile speech, vile racism, Islamophobia, colonialism, and outright supremacy.
Yeah.
So the destruction of healthcare facilities, food distribution networks, and sanitation systems has left the population in an extremely perilous state.
But that's not a genocide. But to defend yourself and be a resistance, that's a call for genocide.
Yeah. And terrorism.
Yeah.
So that's something that the likes of Gordon Robertson on CBN News doesn't even flinch at.
Yeah.
You know, deep down believe that Israel has the right to commit genocide. I mean, it seems that way, to kill babies, women, to cause deliberate starvation just because they can.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a true projection of what communities run by Christian Zionists in the United States look like.
True.
Who know absolutely nothing, actually, about the true teachings of Christianity.
100%.
We'll end with MSNBC, which hosted military analyst, retired Army General Barry McCaffrey, whose background photo spoke 1,000 words as to who this person really is and what his line of thought represents.
Mm-hmm.
There's a photo of him and Bill Clinton, so you can imagine the ideology.
Mm-hmm.
We came, we saw, we conquered, you know, as Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, I remember that.
Anyway, let's hear what this U.S. military analyst thinks about the ongoing genocide in Gaza.
Well, I think you make an important point. Look, at the end of the day, the suffering of the Palestinian civilian population, the destruction of the infrastructure, perhaps 60% of the buildings in Gaza have been damaged or destroyed, has been intense. And they're obviously trying to get out from under that attack. We shouldn't misunderstand, though, from Israel's perspective, the overwhelming majority of the population wants Hamas destroyed. The families of the hostages are putting intense pressure, as they should, and are understandably, on Netanyahu. But at the end of the day, the Israelis will never forget for 100 years the demented, cruel attack of 7 October, with the death and mutilation and torture and abduction of hundreds of Israeli civilians. So it's tough to see where all this goes. Hamas is under major military pressure. That's the good news. Perhaps it'll nudge them toward release of the hostages.
Wow.
It's like time started on the 7th of October, you know?
Yeah.
So this is the kind of rhetoric, racism, and hatred that the American public are listening to and being exposed to 24/7 when it comes to the genocide. A repetition of the same script concerning October 7th, completely erasing all the aggression, the siege, the occupation, the oppression that the Palestinians have faced decades before October 7th, as we all know, and no mention whatsoever about the vile annihilation of an entire population that is ongoing as we speak.
I don't think the American public even know what is really going on. They don't get to watch it, they don't get to see it, and they are immersed in their own show of media that is just maneuvering their level of consciousness and their mental model.
It's essentially a censorship, and they like to talk about democracy and free press. And
it's the most censored part of the world. Thank you very much, Fuad, for
your
analysis. Ladies and gents, now we move on to Mainstream Media Exposé. It is undeniable that there have been widespread and prominent failures in Western journalism, from the dehumanizing language used about Palestinians to the passive voice largely used to downplay Israeli entity responsibility for the war crimes it is committing. Our digital media expert Sima Itayim has a special analysis of the matter from supposedly prominent Western digital media outlets. Thank you very much for being with us, Sima.
Thank you for having me. So, you know, dissecting these things never gets old. You know, since the start of the Gaza war, Western mainstream media has faced criticism for its perceived bias when it comes to efforts to whitewash Israel's crimes and actions in Gaza. Recently, the BBC's coverage once again came under scrutiny, and the New York Times has been in the spotlight for similar reasons. So pro-Palestinian activists and journalists have pointed out that Western media's portrayal of Israel's assault on Gaza only presents one side of the issue, degrading Palestinians and defending Israel's transgressions, of course, of international law. So just like the BBC, the New York Times, which is a giant, you know, American daily, it's facing criticism for its coverage. Its headline about an Israeli attack on a school in Gaza, the New York Times used a passive voice without specifying who carried out the attack.
Yeah.
We have seen this consistently over the years, not just since 7 October. So in contrast, the news article detailing Russia's assault on a children's hospital in Ukraine explicitly attributed the attack to Russia and employed emotionally charged language, including the term deadly.
Yeah.
However, the NYT updated its headline on the Gaza attack in response to the reaction, this time using the phrase Israeli attack in its headline, which is, you know, a first. Well, not a first, but it's rare. It's rare to even, you know, attribute the strike to anyone. Also, the NYT, in a recent article that was published after the Israeli massacre on the Gaza school compound during the first week of July, published a piece by Raja Abdulrahim and Thomas Fuller, which was called Carnage at Gaza School Compound Adds to Mounting Death Toll at UN Buildings.
Yeah.
Now, let's start with the title before we dive into anything else. Let's take out the name of the place, Gaza, and reread the title. It would say Carnage at School Compound Adds to Mounting Death Toll at UN Buildings. This could be from a tornado, an earthquake, an accident, from anything.
Yeah.
Why explain that Israel bombed them indiscriminately while watching kids play football in the school courtyard? It's unnecessary, it seems. So it's not until the fifth paragraph of the piece that we see the word Israeli army, the term, to begin with. Such a typical Western media bias towards the aggressor against the victim. This is what NYT said about the war crime in paragraph 5. The Israeli military said the strike on Tuesday had been targeting a Hamas member who took part in the October 7 attacks on Israel that set off the war. It did not release details on the identity of the Hamas member or whether the target had been killed. The military said it was looking into reports that civilians were harmed. The explosion came amid a week of punishing airstrikes and fighting across the Gaza Strip, with the Israeli military urging people in Gaza City to once again flee and mediators once again seeking to advance ceasefire talks.
So flee, as you where? Flee where?
We there is nowhere to go. But they think that, you know, if they put out the information that they've told them that there's somewhere safe to go, then there must be somewhere safe to go.
And the wording, punishing airstrikes, I mean, how denigrating is that?
Horrible. So you can see the NYT only mentioned the Israeli army when it was giving excuses as to why the most moral army in the world would bomb a school to begin with, a yard that was filled with displaced civilians, most of whom were children and women. Mm-hmm. They obviously dropped an October 7 pretext bomb and then claimed without any evidence that it was targeting Hamas.
Yeah.
And then in seven words said the Israeli military said it was looking into reports that civilians were harmed.
Oh, really?
Always the same line. Absolutely demeaning to all Palestinian martyrs whom the entire world watched be butchered on live TV after this specific airstrike.
Absolutely horrifying as always. But I want to thank you very much for your analysis in the mainstream media segment. Sima, you're going to stay with us because we're going to talk about how this was spoken about in the social media. Ladies and gentlemen, stay tuned because next we have social media expose. Western journalists who still find excuses for the genocide committed by Zionist Israel and accept the approval this entity garners from its own colonial settlers to annihilate an entire people just because they sought liberation have abandoned basic standards. However, if these journalists hide behind their Zionist establishments, social media in our day and age never forgets and never forgives. Here is Sima Taim with us again with some juice from social media platforms. Thank you.
Always with the juice. So while moral reasoning is just one of the inputs into ethical behavior, and such tests aren't necessarily predictive of what journalists do when they're faced with actual ethical dilemmas in real time, the result should urge caution when evaluating the wisdom of the choices journalists take. So this is the case with the Lancet letter when it comes to, journalists. They either took a leap of omission and decided not to mention the letter that warned that the true death toll of Gaza could be well over 186,000, or they simply falsely stamped it as blood libel and moved on. But as always, social media doesn't move on and is there to criticize. So beginning with a post on X by Louis Alday, founding editor of Liberated Text and editor at Ebb Magazine, who mentioned the Lancet letter and posted a screenshot of its results, receiving thousands of reposts and likes for merely mentioning the results of this medical journal's letter by saying, "The Lancet Medical Journal, it is not implausible to estimate that up to 186,000 or even more deaths could be attributable to the current conflict in Gaza. This would translate to 7.9% of the total population in the Gaza Strip." We have next a Western politician who stood up in his country's parliament and voiced his loud support from Gaza, as the world turns a blind eye and continues to do so. Max Chandler Mather, an MP for Griffith, Australia, who shared the following paragraph about the Lancet. "Medical journal Lancet has found that the total death toll in Gaza as a result of Israel's genocidal invasion could be 186,000, or 7.9% of Gaza's population. The same proportion in Australia would be 2 million dead. So, no, the Greens won't stop demanding sanctions on Israel."
Wow.
Then the MP shared video of himself in Parliament.
"Israel kills Palestinian men, women and children. And then they look around the world and they don't receive a single sanction. A single sanction to stop. They are emboldened and they keep acting. I mean, this motion is a joke. It is a joke as part of a peace process. What peace process? Israel is carrying out a genocide. Israel is carrying out a genocide in Gaza. It's not a peace process. Why is it that 146 countries could find it within their hearts to recognise Palestine right now? Why is it that the Australian government refuses? And how is it that when a Labor senator, Senator Payman, who had the principles and the courage to cross the floor to vote with the Greens to immediately recognise Palestine, why is it that Senator Payman faced more sanctions than Labor has dished out against Israel? What do you all do? What does this Labor government do? They can recognise Israel, but they can't immediately recognise Palestine. You can't end Two-Way's arms trade. You can't cancel the Elbit Systems contract. You can't sanction Israel. And you should all be deeply, deeply ashamed."
Oof, that was a lot.
He's mad, and
rightfully so, because they will be, they have to be ashamed, because this will haunt them in their history, because they stood against the Palestinian people.
So we have to move on. We have Abir, who posted a tweet with the following caption: "The genocide in Gaza is made in the US and UK." Okay, Abir then shared an informative video that garnered thousands of likes and reposts.
"Israel's war on Gaza is made in America and made in Britain. British companies supply Israel with targeting equipment, with armored personnel carriers, with parts for helicopters and naval ships, and parts for military jets. Israel has two squadrons of F-35 jets. 15% of the F-35's component parts are supplied to Israel by Britain."
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I have nothing to add to that.
Yeah.
We have lastly a post on X by Hussam Zumlut, who is, as we all know, the ambassador of the State of Palestine to the UK and former ambassador to the US. He wrote the following: "This is a war of extermination. I told Channel 4 News. A militarized Israeli society knows no option but mass destruction and killing, and it is the responsibility of Israel's UK and US allies to end Israel's genocide in Gaza and occupation of Palestine." Mm-hmm. Now, Ambassador Zumlut shared this interview with Channel 4 News, which this clip from that, the, it, holds the UK fully responsible for the ongoing atrocities in Gaza.
The vast majority of the British people want to see an immediate and permanent ceasefire. All polls, the vast majority want to see an equal application of international law, accountability and punishment for war criminals. The vast majority of the British people want to see an immediate recognition of the state of Palestine. So what we need them to do is to follow the pulse of the British people.
That's is recognition the key thing that you're asking the new Labour government for?
It's a major thing, and it's long overdue. We should not even ask for it. This is our inalienable right. But it's also the right thing to do right this moment, because it provides clarity about the way forward. We have got to give people hope. It provides that clarity, but it also levels the field. For 30 years, it's been Israel and the Palestinians. So Israel interpreted that as a license to grab more land, to inflict more ethnic cleansing. This is a time when the British government, the new one, comes and say, here it is, this is our position, particularly in light of the historic responsibility of the UK, the Balfour Declaration, yeah, and all that has followed since then. Our story is a story of extermination.
Naturally, it was the UK who brought this cancerous regime to our region and made it possible. And it should be the UK also that puts an end to this genocide in Gaza, alongside all the other colonial powers who claim they represent the free world. They have the ability to do so and refuse to do so.
Definitely. If this was a sane world, they will all be held accountable for not only allowing this to happen and arming this, but also just turning a blind eye to all the atrocities that followed their decisions to help Zionist Israel. And thank you very much, Seema, for showing us what social media was talking about this specific letter and how it is impacting the people worldwide, and how the estimates are really just really small numbers compared to the real action on the ground in Gaza. Thank you very much for your analysis. Thank you very much, ladies and gents. Now, stay tuned, because next we have Figures Exposé. A Delta Poll survey has found that more than half of the UK public wants to see the next British government ban arms sales to Zionist Israel amid opposition to the war in Gaza. Almost half of the UK voting public wants to see the next government recognizing a Palestinian state, with support for the move running at 5-1 among Labour Party supporters. The Delta Poll survey of more than 2,000 adults was published on the first week of July. When asked, would you support or oppose the next UK government recognizing an independent state of Palestine, 45% said they support, 13% said they oppose, and 42% said they don't know. The survey found that supporting a negotiated diplomatic settlement between the Israeli entity and the Palestinians was by far the favored approach to the war, with 43% backing that policy. Now, the survey showed 17% support the UN having a role to end the bloodshed, while only 7% backed the Israeli entity military action. When asked, do you think the UK government has generally done the right or wrong thing when it comes to the war on Gaza, there was a clear division among the public. A total of 30% said the policy had been right, but 26% said it was the wrong approach. And when asked, do you support the UK banning arms sales to Israeli regime, 54% of the respondents said they supported the banning, 18% said they opposed it, and 28% said they don't know. Now let us move on to the most notable expose voices for this week. In the northern regions of Gaza, a humanitarian crisis unfolds. Famine and starvation have gripped the area, leaving families desperate for any means of survival. With no food to be found, the people of Gaza have turned to an unexpected source for sustenance, the sea. Now, as the genocidal war continues, aid agencies have desperately been trying to get medicine, food, clothes, and water to the population stranded inside Gaza, but with no luck. Here is Tess Ingram, communications specialist at the UNICEF, explaining why it takes 60 days for the aid to reach people in need, which renders many aid packages expired.
This life-saving aid should be in Gaza, but it's facing huge delays getting to the children and the families that need it. I'll tell you why. First, the aid goes to warehouses in Al Arish, Egypt, where it gets documented and screened. then goes to either the Nitzana border crossing in Israel via several checkpoints where it gets screened again before being sent to Rafah, or for screening an entry at the second crossing, Kerem Shalom, where most of the UN trucks go. Each one of these trucks normally carries about 20 to 30 metric tons of supplies. If we could consistently get about 250 of these trucks in every single day, that would be equivalent to about 25 ships of supplies coming into Gaza daily. It's possible to flood Gaza with aid, but it's not happening. The journey from Al Arish should take about 3 days, but it can take up to 60 days, depending on the backlog of trucks waiting to enter. Right now, about 1,200 UN and NGO trucks are waiting to enter Gaza. Why? Because the processing and screening is long and complex, limiting the number of trucks that can cross into Gaza and slowing the entry of this life-saving aid.
Ladies and gents, with that, we conclude our exposé for tonight. Stay tuned for more eye-opening investigations on Exposé. The truth is just a revelation away.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Recently, Shlomo Dovrat, one of Israel's top technology investors, warned that Israel's ongoing war in Gaza is threatening its industry and could pose a serious risk to Israel's economy. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Middle East Monitor has covered this story and tells us more. According to reports in Israeli media, since the launch of Israel's genocidal war in Gaza, the regime's economy has been seriously damaged, with tens of thousands of businesses forced to down their shutters. The Hebrew language newspaper Ma'ariv, in a recent report, stated that since the war broke out on 7th of October last year, around 46,000 businesses have so far closed down in the occupied territories. Referring to the collapse of the Israeli regime, the Israeli Information Services and Credit Risk Management firm Coface BDI estimated that nearly 60,000 Israeli businesses will be closed down by the end of 2024. Yoel Amir, the chief executive officer of Coface BDI, told the Israeli newspaper Ma'ariv that almost no sector has been spared. The report said labor shortages, declining sales, high interest rates and financing costs, transportation and logistics issues, shortages of raw materials, restricted access to agricultural areas in combat zones, absence of customers involved in the war, supply chain disruptions and increased procurement costs are among the major challenges facing the Israeli economy. Sounding warning bells, the report said, about 77% of businesses that have been closed since the beginning of the war, which make up about 35,000 businesses, are small businesses with up to 5 employees and are the most vulnerable in Israel's economy. It also highlighted that the construction industry and the entire ecosystem that operates around it are among the most vulnerable industries in Israel amid the war, now in its 10th month. The report added, the ceramics, air conditioning, aluminium building materials and more, all of these were significantly damaged. The report noted that there has been almost no foreign tourism since the war broke out in October of last year. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz reported recently that, according to the Central Bureau of Statistics, between January and June of this year, just over 500,000 tourists arrived in the occupied Palestinian territories, a 76% drop in comparison to the same period last year, when there were just over 2 million tourists visiting the occupied territories. The report by Maariv also said other hardest-hit sectors of the economy include the trade sector, which includes the fashion industry, footwear, furniture and housewares, and the services sector, including cafes, entertainment and leisure services, as well as transportation. It said the agricultural sector, which is mostly located in the combat zones in the south and the north, suffers from acute shortage of manpower. The report noted, the damage to the Israeli economy is extensive on all fronts. When companies close down and cannot meet their financial obligations, it ripples out to affect customers, suppliers, and others within their ecosystem. Recently, Shlomo Dovrat, one of Israel's top technology investors, warned that Israel's ongoing war in Gaza is threatening its industry and could pose a serious risk to Israel's economy. According to Shlomo Dovrat, people are going to leave the occupied territories and create their startups elsewhere, where conditions are more feasible. Earlier last month, the RISE Israel Institute warned in a research report that the continuous drop in the number of active investors in the Israeli technology sector in the occupied territories is extremely concerning and poses a threat to the survival of the local ecosystem. The Israeli economy's dependence on the high-tech sector has significantly grown in the last decade. The Israeli industry last year contributed 20% to local gross domestic product or GDP, versus 6.2% in 1995, and made up 53% of total exports amounting to $73.5 billion, while generating tax revenues for the regime. Tensions have risen between the Israeli regime and the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah in the north of the occupied territories as the war drags on, forcing tens of thousands of Israeli settlers to leave the area. The Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah has frequently said that its attacks on northern occupied territories will cease once Israel ends its genocidal war in Gaza. The war has so far massacred more than 40,000 innocent Palestinians. The exchange of fire across the border has become more intense in recent weeks, with Israeli officials warning of escalation if Hezbollah does not pull back its forces from the border. However, Hezbollah has demonstrated through recent video warnings that it is capable of attacking Israel's key energy infrastructure, such as oil refineries and gas tanks. Hezbollah's leader, Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, declared recently, "Our goal of draining the enemy's economy has now been achieved." The likelihood of escalation with Hezbollah has created fears among Israeli settlers that any full-scale war with the Lebanese resistance movement would plunge the Israeli economy much deeper into the abyss. Russia's Sputnik news agency has also covered the same story. Israeli newspaper Yediot Aharonot in a recent report warned of an economic darkness scenario and the risk that an all-out war with Lebanon could pose to the regime's capital market. The Yediot Aharonot said the risk could involve cyber attacks and continuous hacks, data leaks and the interruption of vital services as well as flight of investors in the stock market. The report says Israel's cyber warfare division estimates that the total cost of cyber attacks in the occupied territories is approximately 12 billion shekels annually, which is about $3.5 billion, a record amount reflecting only the potential economic damage that could occur during a strong northern war. To the south, the Yemeni army's Red Sea operations, which began in November of last year in solidarity with the Palestinians of Gaza, targeted the Israeli-linked ships, have also contributed to Israel's economy's downfall by forcing ships to take longer routes and limiting revenue at key ports such as Eilat. Yemen, in May of this year, moved into a fourth phase of its operation and expanded the scope of its attacks to include the Mediterranean Sea, with new longer-range missiles and bigger warheads. Every sector of Israel's economy, from high-tech to agriculture to tourism to various industries, has been irreparably dented by the raging war in Gaza, a problem exacerbated by the shortage of workforce and precarious situation. The costs of war have already driven up the military and other spending of the Israeli regime, leading to a fiscal shortfall of 7.6% of gross domestic product, or GDP, in June, and breaching the deficit target ceiling of 6.6% that the regime had set out for 2024. On Monday, 15th of July, the Bank of Israel downgraded Israel's growth outlook from its April estimate because of the impact of the Gaza war, with a long way to go for any semblance of normalcy. The Bank of Israel said the war's direct impact on the economy will continue until the beginning of 2025. Amir Yaron, governor of the Bank of Israel, said the war has considerable economic ramifications which impact Israel's economy. There is still a very long way to go before fully returning to normal activity. In February of this year, the U.S. credit rating agency Moody's downgraded Israel's rating and outlook from stable to negative.
The U.S. Navy hijacked an Iranian oil tanker near Venezuela. On the other part of the world, in the Persian Gulf, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps Navy has taken a U.S. oil tanker as compensation. Unlike the Iranian tanker, U.S. oil tanker was fully escorted by a U.S. warship. The IRGC commandos abseiled down on the tanker and captured it. The U.S. Navy tried to get the tanker out of the Iranian forces' control, but saw a few speedboats in front of the tanker. The warship desperately stopped there and didn't show any reaction. This is how the Iranian commandos stood on the tanker. What's the story behind this scene? What stories has the sea witnessed that the confrontation has led to these moments? Why doesn't the U.S. warship show any reaction?
Wartime memories live again with the news that five capital ships of the Royal Navy, Queen Elizabeth, Valiant, Nelson, Rodney, and Renan, are to be scrapped.
Wednesday, July 1st, 1936, the Hamburg port. Adolf Hitler, the Reich of the Nazi Germany, inaugurated the most important warship in Germany's history. Britons have also unveiled their vessel, a monster that was supposed to be used for the First World War, but it was ready at the end of the war, and it was now equipped with the highest degree of power to fight with the Germans. Two monsters faced off on Saturday, May 24, 1941, in a historical battle in the ocean. for the large number, the speedboats are the vanguards of the conflict and launch 107-millimeter rockets towards the enemies. The rockets work like a shower of explosion. Although they might not be able to have any effects on larger vessels, it jams their radar system so badly that it opens the space for the missiles to strike. In the early 2010s, Iran broadcast images that it showed it had downed one of the planes intact. Iran accessed the strategic drone, and soon it will fly the first prototypes of the RQ. In 2002, the U.S. Navy started designing a vessel that was stable amid tumultuous waves at sea. It could send boats to the sea, and a helicopter could land on it. Just like the Sea Shadow, the vessel was designed based on high speed and remaining stealth. The Sea Shadow paved the way for production of several high-budget destroyers. The destroyers were Zumwalt class, or DDG. A destroyer is a resistant battle cruiser with high maneuverability. It can accompany naval and battle fleets and protect them against small but powerful vessels. In fact, the vessel is a logistic but fast ship that has the capability to carry a helicopter. Therefore, now that the fast ship has entered the ocean, Iranians will have missile launchers on fast vessels and ocean liners. The development dates back to January of 2021. Some information was released on a vessel named Martyr Soleimani. While everyone was waiting for the vessel to be unveiled, the IRGC showcases the Rezvan. The Rezvan joins the IRGC naval fleet. Their cannons have the capability to target objects in the air. Their helicopters are equipped with the highest level of mine-sweeping facilities, and in practice, the Independent has no fear of battlefields. But the reality shows outside the world of advertisement, the vessels are grappling with major shortcomings. First of all, there are many reports that cracks have emerged in their hulls. The maintenance costs are very high, and worst of all, there are many rumors about their armor. Therefore, it is unlikely such a vessel can confront the IRGC speedboats with a speed of over 180 kilometers per hour. The Independent vessels are considered a complete failure. The failure cost the U.S. over $10 billion. The U.S. Navy refused to accept other products in this class and took to other types of coast vessels and designed vessels known as Constellations. The Constellations are supposed to simultaneously engage with 365 speedboats and destroy them while they provide cover for themselves from the air and surface. The United States military ideas are raised and assessed in this exhibition. But producing the first Constellation ship, which can be tested in a real situation, will take at least until 2026. In the years that the battle on the water has turned in an important issue between Iran and the U.S., Iran unveiled aircraft that are more boats than aircraft. The plan is modeled after the flying boats by the former Soviet Union, which were developed in Iran.
During the Cold War, the Soviet Union reached a technology that could move a ship on water as fast as a plane and move over 1,000 soldiers. These monsters are called acroplanes. In recent years, there have been rumors that acroplanes will return to the Russian battlefields. Russia wants to develop the